Today, the next crisis has arrived. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, where I've made his posts covering finance and prop news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, it's another Friday afternoon, and Tarek has joined me once again. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you, mate?
Yeah, pretty good. Now, I gather you're going through your 50 Eden slides and trying to work out which are the most apposite, because there's so much to talk about today, again.
there certainly is. Like, we're going to have to miss so many issues that are just going absolutely off tap at the moment. Everything's happening. You've got, you know, the Russians losing their Black Sea flagship. You've got yields going to the moon. You've got the Japanese yen, you know, doing its best impression of a rocket as the Bank of Japan tries to balance yield curve control and the currency. Everything's happening, and we just can't get through it all in an hour or so.
No, absolutely. And that's interesting that Canada put up their base rate or cash rate by 50 basis points, as did New Zealand. Everybody but Australia is talking about rates going up. So I don't think Australia can not play that game.
No. Sooner rather than later, they're going to be forced to join them. Because if you look at the bank bill swap rate in indices on how much bank funding costs are, that's rising whether the RBA manages to, you know, finally get its stuff together and intervene or not. So, you know, we've already seen that with rising fixed rate mortgages. And if the RBA doesn't step in, we're going to start to see out of cycle rate rises from the banks, whether the RBA wants them or not, as we did see previously when bank funding costs took off in 2018 and 2019.
Absolutely. Well, there were more fixed rate rises this week from CBA and Westpac and a few others as well. And in fact, the Bank of Queensland results that came out just a couple of days ago really highlighted the massive margin compression. You know, the banks will have to lift those variable rates, and quite soon, whatever the Reserve Bank does.
Indeed. And we're seeing these pressures around the world. I mean, Australia is now the last Anglosphere central bank to not raise interest rates. Pretty soon, we're going to be the only... You know, in fact, once the Fed moves, as is expected, we're going to be the only Anglosphere central bank not to have raised interest rates by at least 50 basis points. And if this, you know, the rhetoric about waiting until after the election is correct, well, we could be, 100, 125 basis points behind the rest of the Anglosphere by then.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. The only, thing to highlight, I guess, is that we are very much commodity exposed, our economy, relative to the others, right? And in a way, that does give us a bit of a get out of jail card for a little while, particularly with the way that commodities are going, because more and more of, the world is drifting to see that commodities is about the only safe haven that there is relative to everything else. So maybe that will give us a little bit of elastic, but I suspect it will ping back rather quickly and rather painfully.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, the RBA has been given that scope by the rising Australian dollar. I mean, if we didn't have the commodity issues, if we didn't have the war in Ukraine, and, you know, that we saw a much lower in coal and thermal coal and iron ore, you know, Australia's, you know, one of Australia's major exports, then, you know, there would be probably more pressure for the RBA to hike rates, because the Australian dollar would be getting hit, because, you know, you can buy a US bond that yields a lot more than an Australian bond at the short end of the curve, 1, 2, 3 years. But, you know, it's interesting just seeing how all this is balancing out, because practically everything really is based on this idea that the Chinese are going to stimulate the hell out of their economy, that there's going to be this huge, you know, construction driven boom later in the year as we head towards the Party Congress in October. You know, when Xi is confirmed as leader for life. And, you know, that is on the, you know, that is on the horizon. But so far, none of that has materialized. This demand for commodities has not yet materialized. So it's going to be really interesting in that regard, because if it doesn't materialize, as you say, it's going to snap back quite quickly, and Australia could get hit, like the Australian economy could get hit like a truck, and the dollar along with it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the final point before we get into your slides, you know, how independent is the RBA? Because if they were going to really do what they should be doing, they should ignore the election and just put rates up, right? And there is track record. They did it once before, I think the week before Rudd was brought in, right?
Yeah, Yeah, they did. John Howard was forced to go on television and apologise to the people of Australia for the increase in the cost of living, which I thought was a bit silly, you know, because at the end of the day, it's not, you know, the responsibility for interest rates doesn't solely rest with the government. It's a much, much more complex thing. But that's what happens when you say that you're going to keep interest rates lower and you make those claims, whether they're correct or not. And ironically, Scott Morrison's in that same position again, because he's, you know, rates are going to be lower under a coalition government.
Yeah.
You know, well, they shouldn't be low at the moment. They should be a lot higher than what they are if we want to address inflation.
Yeah. And, you know, without going into too far, the politicization of the Reserve Bank is pretty extended now. And the fact that it's aligned around the Council of Financial Regulators, where Treasury also sits, both formally and informally, they're not as independent as they would like to position themselves as to be.
No. And I've got some slides on where inflation's going. And I think that will be a quite poignant sort of little point on the RBA's inaction.
Okay, well, let's get going with the slide, shall we?
Yes, let's. Well, as always, we've got a nice little cartoon. This time it's Jerome Powell and it trying to catch American bond yields. And right now they are rocketing. We are seeing bond yields break, you know, multi-decade trend lines, which some people are saying is heralding the end of low rates, and that, you know, this is the beginning of a higher rate, higher inflation future. You know, personally, I think that let's see what happens when the Fed starts to break something first. But, you know, they could be right. They could be wrong. It's going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, the only thing they should have done with that particular cartoon is just a little bit of bird poop out the back as well. That would just...
yeah, all over the glasses, eh?
Exactly.
Okay, now, this is what I was referring to with regards to the RBA. According to ANZ, they estimate that the inflation for Q1 for Australia is going to come in at about 4.7%. Now, if they are correct, now this data will be coming later this month. If they are correct, the pressure on the RBA to raise interest rates will be fairly significant, particularly considering that interest rates at the moment are only 0.1%, and Australian interest rate moves tends to be in multiples of 0.25%. So we could easily see them raise rates by 0.15% to then, you know, resume the normal hiking cycle later on in the year. So there is that scope there for a small tap up on interest rates during the election campaign, particularly if this inflation number does come in closer to 5%.
Well, you know, I said a little while ago they should be doing it. In my view, they should definitely be signalling their intent. And of course, the markets have been for some time saying rates are going a lot higher, a lot higher, a lot higher. But we'll see. I've always highlighted the fact that central banks are great at the talk, but quite often the talk doesn't follow much action. I mean, look at the Fed. They've been talking about doing a whole lot of stuff, right? Well, they made one interest move last time. They're still doing the quantitative stuff at the moment, so there's nothing changed on the balance sheet. So a lot of talk, little action.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that just points to the fragility of the system, you know, just the fact that we have built a system on low rates, on QE, and if you start taking that away, things are going to start to break in relatively short order. And, you know, I think that's going to be something that's going to be really interesting to watch going forward, because it's not going to take much to start breaking major things in the economy and just things more globally. Because, you know, we've already seen Russia default. We've seen Sri Lanka default. There is well and truly the potential for an emerging markets debt crisis to take hold, particularly if we do see commodity prices continue to rise and we do see the US dollar continue to strengthen as the US tightens monetary policy. So if we do see this flow of money back into the developed world, that's going to cause even more problems. So you've just got this potential for this really challenging feedback loop to emerge within the global economy.
And just worth thinking about US mortgage rates, right, now hit 5%.
Yes.
Very, very significant raise of rates. Now, I know a lot of people have fixed rates, so it doesn't hit them immediately, but any new rates, mortgages will be at a hard rate. But it's very symbolic in terms of the trajectory of rates, and that's going to put huge pressure on the consumers.
Absolutely. And as you might have guessed, we've got a slide for that later in the show. Okay, now... People, we often talk about the hollowing out of the Australian economy. Martin and I. So here's a bit of a chart showing what's effectively happened as the economy has become hollowed out over time. Now, business investment as a percentage of GDP has peaked shortly after the financial crisis, basically at the same time as the mining boom, because you know you saw all these mining companies throw all this money at production and ramping things up as Chinese stimulus flowed through. But since then, even with the sizable investments in mining that mining companies and explorers continue to make in preparation for, you know, the so-called, you know, the green revolution of, you know, battery powered electric vehicles, home batteries, etc. It's not really translating into higher business investment as a percentage of GDP. In fact, even prior to COVID, business investment as a percentage of GDP was roughly where it was during the challenging period of the 1990s recession. And as the chart on the right shows, this, well, poor environment, shall we say, for business and for households has translated into household income growth going nowhere between 2013 and the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah, and in fact, if you strip out the investment in the mining sector in terms of business investment and look at it net of mining, it's even more extreme. The level of business investment now is lower than it's been, well, forever in terms of percentage of GDP. There is almost no real strategic investment in business in Australia, and that's a really big worry.
It is, and it boggles the mind that we are experiencing an election campaign at the moment where this hasn't rated a mention. You know, you'd think that business investment collapsing to, you know, even including the mining sector, to recession level lows when you've got the Prime Minister going around talking about how fantastic the economy is and how things are better than ever, was just a bit ridiculous. I mean, how can you've got households going backwards in terms of inflation adjusted incomes, and you've got business investment flatlining to recessionary levels. So there's really not that much to crow about in that regard, but it doesn't stop them.
Well, let me talk about definition of fantastic, right? Because, you know, fantastic can mean great, superb, et cetera, right? But fantastic also has another meaning, which is completely mythical and, you know, unrealistic and not real. Clearly, he's using fantastic in the latter definition rather than the former definition.
So we're talking sort of like the classic, you know, 19th century old boys club. Oh, yes, that was quite fantastic. Oh, yes.
Exactly right. Well, I mean, the numbers don't lie, right? There is insufficient investment in business. There is insufficient manufacturing onshore. And none of the settings of either of the main parties are actually going to do anything about it. That's nuts.
No, exactly. I mean, you know, we give, you know, the Morrison government a fair bit of stick for this, but you know, the same thing applies to Labor. You know, they don't really have a let's call it a major plan to change that. Because at the end of the day, you've got the housing monster sucking up all this excess, well, not all this excess capital, all this capital into the housing sector. You know, I mean, you know, why would you invest in a business when you can get, what was it, over the last 12 months, 25% returns on just buying a house? And not only that, the government will pay you to lose money in the meantime.
The old housing event horizon, right? It just sucks everything else into it and nothing much is left. And it's worth highlighting the fact that neither of the major parties really have much to say about almost anything, right? This is almost a content-free election campaign.
Yeah, it is. And without going off on a 15-minute rant about this, it does really get me the fact that we have some of the lowest rental vacancy rates in Australian history, in some cases in Australian history, depending on locale. So we have a massive rental crisis. We've got, you know, children in schools who've had the challenge of dealing with the pandemic over the last 2 years, kids who've fallen behind. I know because once upon a time, I was one of those kids and I did need a lot of help to get to be able to catch up in terms of reading and writing. And without it, I would have been stuffed. I never would have gone on to be a journalist and do what I do today. And those kids deserve help. But is anybody talking about that? A few people are, but not many. It's not the political issue that it should be. And it's just a bit, you know, without, you know, going off tap and getting, you know, getting rather frustrated about this, we as a society should be you know, talking about that, and so should our politicians.
Yeah, well, as I say, my concern is that we have a content-free election campaign, right? There's a few slogans wishing around on a couple of issues, but there is really no thorough thought and thorough putting out on the table a vision for the future. Neither side has any real clear vision for what Australia is likely to be in 10, 15, 20 years' time. That's a huge down mark on both sides of politics.
Well, I've over the last couple of years, I've often called the Morrison government a small target government. You know, there's, you know, ideologically driven things here and there. You know, we've obviously seen emergency policies and stuff like that because of the pandemic. But in relative terms, in terms of, you know, transformative policies, in terms of making the country better, in terms of providing a vision, it hasn't been there. And of course, Labor has adopted a small target strategy because that's what works in Australian politics in the modern world. So, you know, what we've ended up with is just, you know, a whole lot of white noise and not a whole lot of anything else, unfortunately. But, you know, I guess it is what it is.
It certainly is. And the only question is, do you blame the politicians or do you blame the voters, right? I think it's a bit of both, personally, but maybe I'm just biased.
No, it is both. I mean, you know, I mean, what do they say? You get the government you deserve. Yep. I mean, I think it was a French philosopher who once said that.
Yep.
Forget which one. Okay. Now, this refers to what we're talking about earlier in terms of China. Now, there's this idea that eventually China is going to have to stimulate enormously, that it's going to throw all this money at the construction sector, it's going to bail out the property sector, and everything's going to go back to normal. And iron ore is going to go to the moon, and we're all going to be able to buy Toyota Land Cruisers and investment properties. Now, I have rather serious doubts about that theory, because on one hand, you've got President Xi saying that China will stick to COVID zero, which, good luck with, I mean, as Australia learned with the Omicron variant and its various variants, it doesn't really work. It keeps spreading. I mean, look, you know, we've seen Shanghai now in lockdown for several weeks, and there's really no end in sight in that regard for a city that has the same population as all of Australia. And then on the other hand, the Chinese premier came out, I believe it was either yesterday or the day before, and said that the Chinese government is going to expend its resources on boosting consumption. Now, when you've got 40% of your economic output in terms of cities and provinces in lockdown, you're going to have to spend an absolute shedload of money supporting those people, because China doesn't have the same default social safety net that Australia or the rest of the West has. So an enormous amount of resources is going to have to be expended on just propping up these businesses, propping up these households. And not only that, but also the local governments who rely on the tax revenue that comes from those particular entities. So how much resources is there actually going to be left to be able to do all these things that the people seem to believe the Chinese government's going to do, that's going to support demand for bulk commodities?
Yeah, it does beg an interesting question. And of course, he's being re-elected, isn't he? For, you know, basically a premier for life up later in the year. So he's casting a very interesting path. But it doesn't seem to me as though he's going to walk away from COVID zero. And I was talking to somebody the other day who actually has friends up in Shanghai, right? And it was originally, I think, about a 4 or 5 day lockdown. He said, well, somehow 4 or 5 days is now 2 weeks and we haven't got an end date.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we've all seen what you know, the COVID creep can do. You know, 2 weeks to flatten the curve turns into 3 months, into 4 months, 5 months, 6 months, you know, even here in Australia. So, you know, I mean, when you've got an entity like the Chinese government, which is basically unable to admit of making a large-scale mistake like this without significant backlash, they just keep doing what they're doing. So, you know, we don't realistically know where this ends. You know, I mean, we've seen this huge backlog of ships forming at Shanghai, at Ningbo, even in Nanjing, which is the world's largest inland port. And it just keeps spreading throughout China. You know, more and more supply chain issues, more and more disruptions. You know, we've seen, you know, car companies and other manufacturers cut production. So, you know, I think we're stuck with this double whammy of weakening global demand and higher inflation, both due to the war in Ukraine, the sanctions, and the lockdowns in China.
Just don't mention the higher interest rates, huh?
Now, this basically just in data form just confirms what we're seeing in China, just that the in terms of the movement of logistics, of trucking, things are slowly collapsing. And, you know, like as I was saying, that 40% of China's economic output is impacted. And we've seen an even larger drop off in terms of the movement of goods and the flow of freight. So, you know, it's getting quite challenging out there. And it, not only that, but the reality is that, you know, I mean, perfect example is your chats with Edwin, you know, with his Chinese whispers. You know, things are getting worse in terms of the spread of these lockdowns.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of building and construction in Australia is directly reliant on products coming in from China. So the knock-on impacts of this, not just in China, but around the world, are going to be huge.
Absolutely. I mean, if this continues, I mean, I don't think it would be out of line for me to say that if COVID zero continues for, you know, the foreseeable future, you know, well into toward the end of the year, Australia will have a recession. Because we're going to run out of goods, and the demand for bulk commodities is going to fall off a cliff, because they're going to be spending so much money on supporting these households who are frankly livid with being stuck in these lockdowns, that they're not going to have the resources to expend on these huge stimulus packages without potentially driving inflation to the moon, which is something that the Chinese truly fear.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Interesting times.
The oil situation. It's a very interesting one. There'll be an article of mine coming out at news.com either over the weekend or on Monday or Tuesday. Just depends, because it is the Easter weekend. And basically, in recent days, we've actually seen oil demand drop off a cliff because of what's going on in China with the lockdowns, etc. And also the fact that the US Strategic Petroleum Reserve release of 1 million barrels a day has also added oil to the market. So we've actually seen some downward pressure on oil, despite the fact that in the long term, once China comes out of lockdown, whenever that is, it's going to be met by significantly lower production of oil coming out of Russia. This is a chart from an analyst at Bloomberg. There'll be a link to all this, the various charts in the description. And if you want to explore them, they're all there. And I recommend the chart's creator. He's quite a good fellow at explaining all these things. And basically, Russian oil production is expected to drop rather significantly, to drop well below 9 million barrels of oil a day. So that is 2.5 million barrels of oil that the world's going to need to find in the next 6 months as the Strategic Petroleum Reserve ends. The release ends, and as China at some point finally resumes normal activity, it's going to be very, very challenging and a very, very unbalanced oil market, I think, in the final quarters of this year.
Yes, and OPEC Plus basically said, well, we're not going to increase supply that much, a little bit to get back to where we were pre-COVID, but that's about it. And then they said, well, because the rest of it's actually not standard market, you know, supply demand, it's other stuff, so we're not going to actually counteract that. So yeah, I think the oil markets are in for a very interesting and bumpy ride.
Yeah, I agree. I think this one rather speaks for itself. Basically, that growth optimism about the global economy has reached its lowest level since the history of the Bank of America survey began back in the mid-90s. Now, this includes the Asian financial crisis. It includes the popping of the dot-com bubble, COVID, and the financial crisis, and people are more bearish now than they have been in any time in almost 30 years. And to be completely frank, this is one of those few times that I think that their bearishness is actually entirely justified, and things could get quite challenging, I think.
Absolutely. And in fact, a couple of other estimates of global growth, I think, dropped from 5% to 3% because of what was happening in Ukraine and the oil crisis that came out this last week. And every time I read analysts, they're all saying growth is definitely easing back. Trying to quantify it and trying to understand how sticky or otherwise that growth trend is the real problem, right? Because there are so many variables. And, you know, anybody trying to model this stuff, you've got to make so many assumptions. But actually, if you put all together, the signals would be extremely bearish in terms of growth.
I agreed. I mean, it's hard to quantify what's going on in emerging markets at the moment because there is so much upheaval. There is rising interest rates, which we still don't know exactly how that's going to impact those economies, which is still coping with the after effects of the pandemic. Then in the Western world, we're seeing a rapidly slowing Europe. We're seeing a rapidly slowing US. And in China, you've got lockdown. So it's a pretty challenging set of circumstances. And I mean, really, it's hard to nail down exactly what's going to happen in that regard because there are so many different things that could occur. Say, for example, with sanctions, if Europe turns around tomorrow and says we're not going to buy any more Russian oil, well, you're going to have a European recession on your hands in relatively short order. I mean, I personally think one is going to happen anyway, you know, probably either later this year or early next, but you're going to get it a hell of a lot earlier, which is then going to have knock-on effects elsewhere. So there really is that tangled web effect, I think.
Mm, absolutely. Well, my sort of forward view is that we'll see interest rates rise because the central banks will have to react to the inflationary pressures. It won't really have that much impact on inflation, but the growth will come off, and then they'll have to start going the other way again, and they'll go around another loop of throwing more stimulation at it to try and keep growth. Because, frankly, the problem is that if growth goes away, it makes the inflation situation even worse.
But the question is can we, I mean, in the short term, yes, obviously if you see interest rates rise, you see the Fed start to tighten until something breaks, which is historically what they do almost every time. They tighten, something breaks, they jump in and then they're forced to fix it. You know, we've seen that with the repo crisis. We've seen that with COVID. We've seen that with, well, pretty much everything. But the question is, with the lockdowns in China, with social unrest global, you know, potentially on a global scale, the war in Ukraine, which with the sinking of the Russian Black Sea flagship Moskva is now arguably significantly more likely to last longer, and for the sanctions that go with it to last longer, you put all those factors together, even if you do see, say, for example, the stock market breaks or the high yield bond market breaks, yes, commodity prices will fall on that because that's what they historically do. But the problem is once the dust settles, everyone's going to go, well, we've still got these supply imbalances.
Yep.
We've still got all these problems. We've still got supply chain issues. So the so we may break the economy, we may break the market, but we may not break the back of inflation as we traditionally do under these circumstances. So at that point, it's open season because we're in completely uncharted waters.
Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? The fact is that lifting interest rates is going to deal with inflation when inflation is very much driven by wages and all those things. But when inflation is being driven by supply chain disruptions, it's a really big question as to how lifting interest rates actually does impact inflation. Okay, you might turn down a bit of demand, but it's not as straightforward as perhaps one would think.
I think the thing is that it's a matter of degrees. I think that it is a very simple, you know, calculus. You know, you raise interest rates by X amount. There's X amount of household and business debt, and therefore you reduce aggregate demand by X number of billions of dollars. Now, you can kill inflation. You can easily kill inflation anytime you want, but you have to be able to absolutely brutally raise interest rates in order to do so. So, you know, I mean, people are saying two and a half, three, four, five percent in Australia cannot happen in terms of the cash rate. Now, I'm not saying that it will, but I'm saying that it's possible. If we continue to see these inflationary pressures coming from external problems and coming even from internal problems, because we've created, say, for example, the home builder issue with excess demand for something due to government intervention, there is a world where the inflation continues, even if you break the back of the market and even if you send the economy into a recession. If it's not a brutal enough recession, it may not be enough to break the inflationary impulse. Because after all, even here in Australia, households have $250 billion they're sitting on. It's entirely possible that you could have a massive bifurcation between the different parts of Australia, where the affluent inner city areas, the ones with all the money, you know, and all the savings, do extremely well, and retail sales in those areas continue to prosper. Meanwhile, everyone else out in the rest of the world, in the rest of the country, gets smashed by rate rises and has the economy in those areas wrecked, but the inflation may still continue because there is still that other spending as well. So it's really, really complex in that regard.
Absolutely, it is. And the point, I think, to underscore is that all of the simple levers that people talk about pulling, right, have unintended consequences. And quite often, one lever is interacting with another lever, which is interacting with a third lever, right? So there are no simple solutions to the problem that has been created by, well, 20 years of bad policy and 15 years of central banks doing stupid things.
Yeah, pretty much. It's all a result of stupidity and refusing to accept the impact of that stupidity, instead just kicking the can under, you know, down the road and making an even bigger crisis.
Yep.
Okay, this is what Martin and I were talking about earlier. U.S. mortgage rates have risen, well, in a big, big way. They bottomed out in the early part of 2021 in January at around about 2.65%. Since then, the benchmark U.S. 30-year mortgage rate has risen to 5%. So it's very nearly doubled. Now, going back, as there was a chart, I believe, a couple of weeks ago, going back, this is the largest relative increase in U.S. mortgage rates since at the very least the 1980s and possibly ever. So eventually U.S. housing is going to hurt. However, I will point out that around 90% of U.S. mortgages are on fixed rates of generally between 15 and 30 years. So unlike Australians, who are going to get hit relatively immediately, for people who have, you know, for the roughly 50, 60% of people here who have variable rate mortgages, most Americans aren't going to feel rising rates, which means, let me rephrase, they're not going to feel rising mortgage rates. So it's going to take longer for this to feed through. But when it does, the US is potentially facing another rather significant housing downturn.
Yes, well, there isn't the same variable reset there was. You know, when what caused the global financial crisis was effectively these really cheap mortgages that then actually were reset at a higher rate, and that higher rate was set because essentially rates had gone up. So a lot of people got caught, and a lot of people who should have never got a mortgage in the first place got a mortgage. They haven't got that same problem this time, so far as we know yet. Although there's maybe something below the surface, we'll wait and see. You know, but the point to make is, as you say, a lot of people have long-term fixed rates. But it does mean that anybody new going in to buy a property for the first time and getting a mortgage for the first time is now looking at least a 20% higher repayment. And that's equivalent, you know, something like a couple of interest rate rises or, you know, with house prices going up 20% or whatever. I mean, it really is a big extra impost on those marginal borrowers who are thinking of perhaps going to the market. So this could have quite an insignificant impact over time.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I think that realistically, if rates do stay high, you're baking in another US housing downturn, a rather large one at that. I think that obviously it's going to be very, very different based on locale, because some areas have shot up 50, 60, 100% over the last 2 years, while other areas, you know, have only moved up maybe 5, 10, 12%. So it's going to be really interesting to watch in that regard. But I mean, as I said on Twitter, I believe it was yesterday, I don't think that US housing is going to be the thing that breaks the market, that breaks the economy this time. I think it's going to be something else. Because I think it's just because, as you say, the makeup of these mortgages is different. It's going to take longer to feed through. It's going to take longer for the prices to start to fall, you know, as significantly as they did back in, you know, 2008. I mean, for example, I mean, you know, the Case-Shiller housing price index peaked in late 2006, and it was 2008 before, you know, you really started to see things kick off in terms of an actual crisis. So I mean, I think we're going to rather see some rather more immediate issues in other markets.
Yeah, I think so. And I think you're going to see corporate debt in the US being hit first, because there are a lot of highly leveraged companies out there who have very cheap debt at the moment, but that debt is being reset and already being reset at much higher levels. But the other point just to make, you know, look and weep, look at the average house price in the US, you know, $300,000, $400,000 US, right? Compare that with Australian average house prices. We are so over leveraged and we're so off the scale relative to the US that the sensitivity that we have in the economy here to interest rate moves is much bigger. And of course, as you said, we have a much higher proportion of variable rate loans, which means that if rates go up, either out of cycle or thanks to the RBA, it hits immediately.
It's kind of insane. Oh, and I just to make one little correction to what I mentioned in our last show. I said that if Sydney housing prices halved, that they would be roughly the same price as the US average. That was very much incorrect. If Sydney housing prices halved, they would be around about 7-ish times household income. In the US, the median house is 5 times household income. So I just want to apologize for everyone. Australian housing is even more of a value than I said relative to the US.
Oh, of course, it's gone up since last week anyway.
Well, not this time. Not this time. Things are changing in Sydney, you know, with the falling auction clearance rates, and all of a sudden, you know, market's got the jitters.
It's fascinating how many headlines there have been in the online news services about house price falls in Sydney, right? That's not happened before, but quite a few this time. And, wherever you look, you start to see the first early signs of prices come back. In fact, somebody the other day sent me a message to say, hey, this $4.5 million house has now been on the market at $3.5 million. Suddenly there's a big move. I mean, that's just an extreme example. But if you look at the data, things are definitely on the turn now. And this, remember, is before rates are rising.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I quite like this chart because it shows the makeup of US inflation. And one of the things that you'll notice if you go back to prior to the pandemic is goods inflation in the US has basically been non-existent for years because of, you know, outsourcing, because of China, etc., automation, you name it. Goods inflation has basically been a non-existent force in the US CPI for quite a long time now. But now US goods inflation is starting to come back. And as you see the effects of the reversal of globalization, the reshoring of supply chains, the rebuilding of inventories, as you know, the just-in-time model of, you know, just ordering it from China a few weeks or a few months before you need it starts to fall apart. And the idea, and it's like, oh crap, now we can't get it in time, and you need to have those larger inventories. All that adds to costs. All that adds to higher levels of inflation within goods more broadly. But the thing that I think is the most significant about this chart is the way that services inflation is taking off. Now, it may not look like much, but services inflation is actually rising very, very, very quickly at the moment. And that is showing that inflation as a broader force, not just in terms of supply chain issues, not just in terms of the cost of energy, but in terms of broad-based inflation, is now becoming a major problem for the US economy. And even if you stripped out everything else, if you stripped out energy, you strip out food, you strip out goods, everything but services, the current level of services inflation is enough to be forcing the Fed to raise interest rates by itself. So that really illustrates that we are going to see continued pressure on the Fed to raise rates long after all these supply chain issues are fixed and energy prices moderate, whenever that ends up happening.
Absolutely. Multifaceted problem. And the other interesting thing, the retail numbers that came out overnight from the US showed that, you know, they were up a little bit. But if you strip out gasoline, in fact, the retail number was lower. So what's happening is that people are having to spend a lot more just to get the things that they want to get. And it's really changing some of the characteristics of what people are buying. And in the UK, again, interestingly, Barclaycard reported a significant rise in credit card transactions because the cost of fuel was so much higher. So therefore, it's sort of artificial. It's not really actually creating more stuff. It's just paying more for the same stuff. And that's, of course, a very interesting phenomenon, which, again, suggests that this inflationary pressure is really quite strong.
No, I concur. And that's something that's been really interesting in the US because people are saying, oh, but look, you know, say, for example, yesterday, headline US retail rose by 0.5% month on month. But, and as you say, there are issues with the inflation factor, and there'll be a chart for that later in the show. But the thing that I think is interesting about that is that those are the retail numbers that are being achieved with the largest expansion in US consumer credit in terms of, you know, things like buy now, pay later, in terms of credit cards, short-term loans, etc. The largest increase in month-on-month increases in US credit in American history. And that is quite mind-boggling, that even with struggling households going to the bank, going to these lenders in order to make ends meet, in order to put food on the table, that retail sales in inflation-adjusted terms are still going backwards at quite a rate of knots.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you stand back more broadly and just think about the volume of stimulation that's been created through government schemes and through central bank quantitative easing and ultra-low interest rates, right? The economic outcomes we've got are shamefully disappointing when you actually think of all the money that's been thrown around, all the private sector credit, all the government sector credit, everything. I mean, it's unbelievable when you think about how much has been thrown at it and how little result we've got.
Exactly. I mean, you know, if you look at, say, for example, US growth in Q4, you know, they managed to achieve less than 0.2% quarter on quarter. And they're still running this enormous deficit. They're still throwing huge amounts of money at people at that point, you know, with the child tax credit, with the fact that student loan payments are being deferred. I mean, the student loan payment deferral, that in and of itself is, you know, $100 billion a year or thereabouts, you know, which is a sizable quantity of money. And it's just like, you know, it's just willy-nilly, you know, whatever. But it's not achieving the outcomes that you would expect with throwing such a, you know, a sizable percentage of GDP directly at households.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay, now this brings me to one that is a budding theory of mine, and I wrote an article about this over last week, and I'll get Martin to include a link in the description. But basically, US personal incomes are falling below trend, even after all of the money that's thrown at them, even after the child tax credits, the other additional stimulus measures. They are now that those measures are falling away and things are normalizing, in inflation-adjusted terms, incomes are falling and falling significantly. Now, what was really interesting is that in terms of inventories, if you look at broader US inventories, you would look at them and you would go, oh wow. They, you know, US retailers need to rebuild their inventories like nobody's business because they're so low. But once you strip out cars, trucks, and auto parts, a very different picture emerges. As you can see from the chart on the right, the total level of inventories is actually risen significantly, particularly in the last few months. So you're starting to see this massive glut of US retail stock. So we've got this really fascinating paradox whereby, on one hand, inflation is rising rapidly, the cost of manufacturing is rising rapidly, but at a retail level, you could see deflation in products because they simply have too much stock. It's no different than, say, for example, you know, after lockdowns ended a few months after, you could go buy a giant bottle of hand sanitizer for $3 that was $15 or $20 before. And it's no different when you end up with a glut of other products. Just on a, obviously, there's just not as large an imbalance between supply and demand. So I think that we could see simultaneous retail deflation and manufacturing inflation for a short period of time within the US economy. And that's bad for corporate earnings, and it's bad for the economy more broadly because retailers don't make any money.
Expect very deep discounts, yeah. Extra sales, right? Anything to get people to buy.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, and you're seeing these inventory builds that, I mean, the fascinating thing is we've seen almost double the inventory build in the last 4 months as we saw in very nearly the previous 4 years. So these inventory builds are occurring incredibly rapidly. And as we go on, there's a few other indicators which I think people will find interesting in that regard. And this is one of them. This is the US trucking index. And basically it measures the demand for truck-based freight. And since it peaked earlier in March, it's basically fallen by about 15%. Now, this isn't due to seasonality. This is just due to demand for freight hitting what is effectively a wall. And you can explain that by the fact that retailers have expanded their inventory so significantly. A lot of them don't need more stock right now. And it's there's this once again, this fascinating bifurcation within the economy, because you've got importers who are in some cases struggling to get the stock from overseas, but you've got retailers who have this, in some cases, have this these enormous gluts of stock. So they're pulling in very different directions. But the reality is, it's bad for the economy, and really, it's crisis and it's a recession indicator.
Well, it's pretty powerful, isn't it? And I've got this vision of lots of warehouses absolutely full of stuff that nobody wants to buy.
Well, that's the thing, like retailers have spent the last 2 years attempting to compensate for displaced services spending, attempting to compensate for this enormous wave of stimulus, of extra cash, of wealth effect driven spending, as people felt wealthier because their assets were worth more, or because they'd been able to sell something for a rather sizable profit. But now all of a sudden, that demand is falling away right at the time when the supply has finally, ironically, arrived.
Timing is everything.
Indeed, indeed it is. Now this is what you're referring to earlier, in terms of the if you exclude gasoline from US retail sales, they went backwards in March by 0.3%. Now, one thing that's important to keep in mind with US retail sales relative to retail sales indices around the world is that they don't factor in inflation. And inflation in March was 1.2%. So in actual terms, in inflation-adjusted terms, US retail sales went backwards to the tune of 1.5% once you factor in the relative spend on gasoline, which is an absolutely insane figure. The idea that a so-called booming economy could have the retail sector go backwards so rapidly is laughable. And I think it points to real, genuine weakness within the US economy before they've really even turned off all these stimulus measures. And I mean, Biden recently announced that they're going to keep the student loan repayment deferral going on because, do you really want to strip $100 billion out of the economy right now in terms of spending? Although, even though that $100 billion adds significantly to inflation, but well, what's extra cost between friends?
Well, and of course, the other point there is that real wages growth are still going backwards in the US. I mean, the absolute growth rate is a bit higher than it was, but the relative, because of the inflation, it's still people are still going backwards. So in real terms, people are having less money to start with, chasing those goods that are more expensive. I mean, you can begin to understand why it is that the retail numbers are going backwards.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and on the left here, that's broader retail sales. Now that I'm just to clarify, that does include things like gasoline, it includes everything. But that peaked a year ago. So really, the US economy is stuck in a situation whereby, in real terms, retail is adding nothing to growth and is going to be unable to add nothing to growth for as long as real wages keep going backwards, unless consumers get even larger amounts of credit to pump into into the economy. So, it's a pretty challenging sort of set of circumstances. And, frankly, that's why, to me, the recession warning lights are well and truly on for the US.
Well, just think about this. A large proportion of growth generally comes from consumers in the US. It's, up to 50% generally. So if they're actually not consuming as anything like more, the growth isn't there, that's a huge hole.
Yeah, and the growth that we have seen up until well, up and for the data that we do have, has been the normalization of the services sector. Now, when the services sector does finally normalize to 100% of the level that it was prior to the pandemic, where's the growth going to come from then? Like, you've got flatlining retail growth at absolute best in real terms, and then you've got a services sector that's finally reached its pre-COVID capacity level. And then and we haven't even talked about the impact of rising interest rates on sentiment, on markets, and how that's going to flow through into the real economy.
A few red lights about.
Okay. Now, before anybody asks, the Bloomberg Journo put Homer Simpson there. It wasn't me. Now, basically, this shows that, you know, while the world would very much like to kick its nasty Russian gas habit, doing so is going to be at best challenging, at worst impossible, because we've got to find all this extra liquefied natural gas from somewhere. And as you can see, the production as it stands, based on current projections, just isn't there. And it's going to be quite a challenging scenario in that regard, because what happens then? Are we just going to see higher LNG prices as people fight over cargoes? I mean, if some of you have been following this in the media or on Twitter, you've seen these big convoys of LNG ships. You know, they're heading to Europe, they're heading to Japan, they're heading to China, etc. And then all of a sudden, they'll be halfway across the Pacific, and they'll do a big U-turn, and they'll head off in a completely different direction to Europe, because Europe needs the LNG, and they're willing to pay more than the Chinese or the Japanese or the Koreans. So I think that's a really poignant illustration of where this is going, of this fight for resources, and it's all going to come down to the bottom dollar. And that bottom dollar, I think, is going to be a highly inflationary factor, unless they can somehow resolve things and, you know, the status quo can resume. And at this point, that seems rather doubtful.
And isn't there another factor here, and that is the liquefaction of liquid natural gas, as it were, is actually environmentally quite problematic. You know, it creates a little bit of CO2 and other stuff. So, in fact, if you're upping the production of LNG, then you're going to have this broader question of the environmental impact and, you know, climate change and all those things in the background too.
Indeed. And there's also the factor of the actual facilities and the logistics of the thing. You know, Europe does not have the port logistics, the transmission logistics, you know, the facilities to be able to convert to LNG usage overnight away from Russian gas. That's going to take years, if not, you know, over a decade, to be able to, you know, fully kick its habit. So you just, it's just an incredibly uncertain situation, and there are no easy answers. And frankly, it's just another inflationary driver for the future. And this is a perfect example of what we were talking about before, just in the sense that this problem is not going to go away. It doesn't matter if the market crashes. It doesn't matter if the economy falls to pieces. You know, if it goes into a recession, this is still going to be an inflationary factor if the current course continues. And that, I think, is one of the really concerning things about inflation going forward, because there is that Russia, you know, that Ukraine factor in fertilizer, in gas, in oil, that could keep upward pressure on inflation even as the real economy struggles quite badly.
And just think about wheat and other things like sunflower oil as well, which, of course, Ukraine was a big contribution. In fact, a report came out last week suggesting that food prices had, in some countries, 95% higher, like in Sudan, for example. And it's actually the fallout, not just in the Western economies, but in some of the emerging markets, which I think is so concerning, because there people spend a greater proportion of their total income just in surviving. So the question is, how many of those will fall off the log as a result?
No, exactly. Exactly right. That's something that you and I have discussed in a couple of our recent chats, and just in the sense that, you know, say you have an issue with a country, say, you know, you pick Chile, you know, which produces, you know, large amounts of copper and other minerals, you know, for global markets. And, you know, there's been a little bit of political wrangling there, but, you know, let's say hypothetically that they have an eruption of social unrest as we've seen around the world, which is not, you know, a completely unprecedented development. That copper gets their copper supply gets impacted. The price of copper globally goes to the moon,
yep.
You know, because they're a rather, you know, not only that, but it's already a finely balanced market as it stands, as we move towards this green future of, you know, renewables, electric cars, etc., which all need an enormous amount of copper. So the price goes up, inflation goes up, you've got another inflationary factor, you've got another thing causing problems, and then you've got another potential butterfly for further unrest as costs continue to rise, and you just have this negative feedback loop of, well, just crappy things happening, really.
It's exactly right.
Speaking of inflation, German wholesale prices to the moon. I believe this is the highest level since comparable statistics began. And I mean, you know, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to know that some of these inflationary pressures are going to be passed on to consumers. It's going to hit them hard. And well, Europe has a problem. And ironically, even Janet Yellen, the U.S. Treasury Secretary, says that. She said, you know, we shouldn't be watching the U.S. for a recession. We should be watching Europe. And while I agree that Europe is probably going to end up in a recession faster than the U.S., at this point, the U.S. may not be far behind if the current trends continue.
Well, that's right. And it's worth just reflecting on the fact, of course, the U.S. with its status as a reserve currency potentially has a even more significant impact on the global economy than what happens in Europe. But I've said for some time, looking at, for example, the state of some of the banks in Europe and their leverage to really uncomfortable places, the financial system and Europe in general could well be the epicenter of the next problem set. So watch this space.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just talking about that on a, you know, just from a broader perspective, recently, the Japanese came out and said the Americans, you know, to that they're monitoring, you know, that the US and the Japanese have been monitoring the yen and the market more broadly. And, you know, I think that's real signaling of, please help, you know.
Well, that's right. And without going down a rabbit hole, it's very interesting to me that Russia has linked the ruble to gold. And, of course, gold and oil are sort of connected, and so suddenly the primacy of the US dollar as a sort of the reserve currency is in an interesting position. And it's interesting how a lot of the mainstream haven't really picked up the significant, I think the ruble gold link is actually very significant.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how it all holds up, you know, with it, because I mean, you know, this isn't the first time that someone has proposed this sort of thing. It's probably the furthest it's ever gotten, but it's just going to be interesting because it's in a lot of ways, countries and leaders tend to side with the devil they know. So I think that that's going to be in the dollar's favor in the sort of short to medium term, but in the sort of, you know, a much, much longer term time horizon, it is going to be interesting to see how that develops because yes, the US economy is probably the strongest of the major economies. You know, China has a fairly significant problem in terms of driving growth without relying on debt-fueled, you know, construction, infrastructure, etc. And because, I mean, not only that, but if the US goes into a recession, you know, the Chinese are going to have a fairly sizable problem keeping their factories fully, you know, going at full chat. So they've got a problem in that regard too, particularly if Europe goes with it. So I think really at this point, it's just a case of broader systemic fragility of just, you know, of what if one domino falls, it could very much take the rest of them, you know. If yield curve control, for example, which I mean the Japanese central bank's attempts to cap yields to stop borrowing costs from rising, if that, for example, blows up, you know, I'm not going to pretend to know that I fully understand exactly what that's going to do to global markets, to asset prices, to everything, because I don't think anybody really knows.
No, exactly. Lots of uncertainty.
Okay, this is the last one for the day. This is the slide number 15 that has been condensed down from the original 50. And it shows the short-term external debts of various nations versus as a percentage of their foreign exchange reserves. Now, you'll notice that the big one on the left there is Sri Lanka, and that has already blown up. They've already defaulted on their external debts. But I think this goes to show which nations are going to have the problems in the months and perhaps even years to come as these issues continue, as the strength of the dollar continues, as all these other problems begin to emerge, and even just as social unrest continues to happen, because, you know, countries not often, perhaps not that often, but in a lot of times they try to solve the problems by printing more money, by throwing more money at the people. And you know, I think you can see how well, you know, that worked out for Sri Lanka. You can see how well that worked out for Zimbabwe.
Yeah, absolutely. And even Turkey's up there, right? Which have, you know, another interesting economy with some significant immediate issues too. And I guess that's the point, that if you sort of stand back and just look geographically around the world, you know, it's not like one or two economies that are actually, you know, in a bit of trouble. Most economies are in a bit of trouble, and some are actually extensive trouble. And you know, Sri Lanka and all the social unrest there, Hungary is doing some stuff, you know, wherever you look people are trying to pull these different levers. It really is a mess.
It is a mess. You know, it's a case of, you know, it's like, well, which country is going to set off the next, you know, I mean, really, as the title of this video suggests, the next crisis has already begun. You know, we've seen Sri Lanka blow up. You've seen issues with Russia. You've seen bond yields go to the moon. You know, things have already started to kick off in that regard. You know, whether, you know, to what degree it's going to kick off, it's going to blow up immediately. I mean, it could happen. I mean, we don't know what's going to break. You know, the yield curve control in Japan could break next week, and we could be talking about a major crisis by the time we next sit down and have one of our little chats. So. You know, the problems are already there. You know, the fuse is lit. It's already occurring. So, it's just a matter of where the big fissures start to open, and then, you know, things start to get even more challenging.
And I guess the sort of the takeout is also, right, in the context of that, how good is the Australian economy? And that's a question, not a statement.
Mm. Yeah. No. And to be honest, not that great. I mean, like we talked about earlier, you know, that domestic business investment that just isn't there, that the other drive, the sort of broad-based drivers of the economy aren't there. And you know, if China does continue COVID zero, and they are forced to divert enormous resources to supporting the households and businesses and the local governments impacted by the COVID zero policy, by lockdowns, etc., it is increasingly challenging to see where they're going to find this money to prop up demand for bulk commodities.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we are heading into that party congress period where, you know, Xi is going to be confirmed as leader for life. And yes, it would be lovely if the economy was humming along, but feeding people, keeping them housed, clothed, and fed is more important than that. And I don't think that the market, you know, I mean, particularly, you know, looking at, say, for example, the iron ore market, I don't think the market has really priced in that will have to be the priority, the first priority, rather than, you know, the traditional debt-based growth strategies that we've seen from the Chinese government.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, my perspective is that some of the fundamental fabric assumptions as to how economies work and how they have worked are under question. And at the moment, the answers are actually not coming. And when you see all the data that you've gone through today and all of the interactions of all of those data, you have to say that we're in the midst of the next crisis already. I'm not sure that anybody knows the way out, though. That's actually the most concerning thing, right? And so we're going to have to muddle along.
Indeed. I mean, to be completely honest, the thing is that you can have strategies to cope with the next crisis based on what its potential catalyst is. But the problem is that how do you address something when you don't know what that catalyst is going to be? You know, you could literally get a monkey with a dart and throw it at a map of the world, and that could be the next catalyst. So, you know, you don't know if it's going to be, you know, the Japanese yield curve control blowing up. You don't know if it's going to be the European banks, an emerging markets debt crisis, the US junk bond crisis, a commercial mortgage securities crisis. I'm not going to go on because I could literally probably sit here for another 20 minutes and just cite different things. But I think you all get the point that there are a lot of different things, and there is no one strategy that really covers them all sufficiently.
It's the Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns.
Right? Yeah.
And that actually at the moment, there's a very, very large bucket marked do not open.
Yeah, and unfortunately, I mean, I think the thing is that we've, if you look at all these various underlying issues, you know, say for example, like EM debt or you know, European banks or whatever, these issues have been there for a long time. They've been there. They've been, you know, in some cases they've been festering for decades. You know, but instead of leaving well enough alone, central bankers and fiscal policymakers have created this, perhaps not created, but brought forward all these various crises. Because, you know, if we were still stuck in the same deflationary world we were in, well, let's call it disinflationary world we were in 2019 before the pandemic started, we wouldn't be talking about yield curve control blowing up in the Japanese government and the Japanese central bank's face. It wouldn't even be a consideration at this point. Don't get me wrong, it's a risk that was always going to be an issue at some point, but it wouldn't be now. But because of all these things that we've done, because of all the things that central bankers have done, all this QE, all this extra money printing in terms of the fiscal side, now we are having to talk about it. Now we are having to talk about an inflationary crisis and the possibility of, you know, even protracted inflation continuing after they've raised interest rates, after they've caused a recession, which is, I mean, I'm struggling to find a precedent for that in the last century in a broad based way. I'm not even sure if it's happened in that way to the current degree that we could potentially be facing.
No, well, I think, you know, there are two observations. The first is that this isn't just one country, right? Pretty much everywhere around the world, they've done similar things, and that orchestrated parallel reaction across most different countries is almost unique. And then secondly, the quantum is huge. So yeah, we're in uncharted territory.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, I think that the big takeaway of all this is that there's just no more easy solutions. You know, there is, like, under more normal circumstances, okay, you know, say for example, all the various things we've discussed today, excluding inflation, you've got a slowing economy, you've got slowing trucking sector, you've got all these other issues that point to a slowing economy. Under more normal circumstances, there'd be a recession, and then the central bank would cut interest rates, they'd start QE, and you'd see stimulus from fiscal policymakers. We can't do those things now. Those things are no longer options without potentially driving even greater levels of inflation. Or on the monetary side, really, really pissing people off. So there really just isn't a strategy or a playbook to cope with these things without creating even larger problems. So it's really fascinating in that regard, because, you know, I like playing the prediction game, you know, being the my own little monkey throwing the dart at the dartboard. But in this instance, I don't see exactly how they're going to get out of this. I mean, obviously there will be a way, there will be some combination of, you know, of pain and stimulus and everything else that is going to get us through this. But, you know, as it stands, I'm not exactly sure what that will be.
Well, I'll leave you with a closing thought. Could it be that actually central banks really don't mind a bit of inflation because inflation reduces the quantum of the debt, and they know that the debt ultimately has to be diffused in some way? And so whilst they'll be doing a lot of stuff around the edges, they actually quietly won't mind a bit of inflation running for some time.
Well, it's going to be interesting in that regard, because while central banks may not mind inflation, the political donor class and the regular everyday people mind inflation a great deal. So it's politically unviable for them to do that. I mean, maybe in certain countries where they can do what they like, but in more general terms, I don't think corporate earnings are going to be too happy. You know, the corporate class is going to be too happy to have their earnings destroyed by rising costs either. So, you know, I think that in some ways, it will eventually be the path of least resistance, but the path of least resistance may be the path of a significant amount of pain.
Yeah, I think pain ahead is probably right. Tarek, interesting conversation, very important conversation too. And, you know, I think, folks, the message today is keep an eye on all the data, because you've got to try and read what's going on. But, boy, is it complex at the moment.
Exactly. Exactly, Brad. I could have been here with the original 50 charts, and it still would have been just as complicated.
Thank you for your research and for your charts. And we'll put links and things below, and we'll do it all again soon.
No worries, mate. Great to see you.
See ya. Take care.
Bye.